Thank you all for coming. I'm sorry there's no typhoon, because I wanted one. Because in Hawaii, when we have typhoons, it's a disaster. And, you know, everything blows up and buildings fall apart. And I wanted to actually be in a typhoon in a place that would be kind of safe. I thought it would be interesting, but I'm told it's not going to happen. So maybe there's still time for one. I'm here for 2 more weeks. So I put my title in here because they just gave me this title, and it's a nice long title. I think it's kind of strange, but they decided at the University of California, Southern California, to call me the Professor of the Practice of Spatial Sciences, which isn't what I would have called myself, but that's what the faculty decided I would be called. And it's a spatial sciences word because I generally consider myself to be a geographic information scientist. That's my field, and that's where my training is. And that's relevant because it's my take on this topic. I'm not a location-based services person. I'm not an engineer. I don't know anything about that particular technology. But I'll explain to you the motivation for doing this topic. And in fact, this is the course I'm teaching here this year. I have taught GIS, geographic information for e-business, I think is what I taught 3 times previously in the program. And my experience in that class, every time I taught it, and most importantly the last time, was that there doesn't seem to be a lot of room for GIS as a career profession in Hong Kong, because it's pretty well tied up. It's all top down. But there are reasons to think about geographic information and to think about location, and it really comes to the top in the location-based services domain. So let me get on and I'll explain to you some of this motivation. But just to be clear at the beginning, there's plenty of definitions for what a location-based service is. This is a nice, simple one. It's an information service. We got to keep thinking this is all about information on the internet. It's an information service provided by a device that knows where it is, and it's capable of modifying the information that it provides based on the knowledge of where it is. So it's all about having a device that's mobile and knows where it is, and the information that it receives and that it requests is based on the fact that it knows where it is, and the service that it's talking to can do something with that knowledge. So that's the context of the location-based service. And as I have on a different slide, it's a pretty hot topic right now. In fact, it's been hot for years, but it never actually got hot. We thought it was hot for a long time. We thought this was the big new thing in about 10 years ago. And then about 8 years ago, we thought it was the big new thing. And then about 6 years ago, we thought it was really going to come. And then finally, I think it really was the iPhones, those smart devices that really made it work. Because previously to that, it made sense, and all of us who knew the technologies knew it could happen. But until people had these really cool things in their pockets that were really user-friendly, it didn't take off. It's definitely taken off now. So the domain of LBS in terms of technology basically starts with the user device, which is some sort of portable thing. It's always, in this context of LBS, it's portable. So you start with a user device, which somehow ties into a set of methods for figuring out position. And then these things, the position information and the device itself with all the other information, it sends something through a communications network of some kind up into the cloud, which we can all have now, which we didn't have before, which is also part of why this is easier, up into the internet cloud. And then that is connected to services that do a bunch of location-based things, like find restaurants and navigate the car and find your friends and find out what's around. And those things connect to a bunch of data. So this is the universe of the location-based services. And I will come back to that shortly. I'm just doing the intro here. Okay, so what can you do with an LBS? You can do tons of things, and anybody in this room who has a smartphone has several of them already on their phones. But in the textbook language, what you do with an LBS are things like resource tracking. So if you have a location, mobile device, you can track taxis and service people like repairmen. You can actually track equipment and doctors, and you can schedule things. You can track packages and shipping containers. All of those things, you can track your resources that are moving around in space because they're giving their location away. You can find people and things. whether it's businesses or places to go or stolen phones or broken down cars, all of those things you can do with this service. Then there's the proximity stuff, which is really basically what we do mostly with it, is either notification that are notices that come to you when you are in a certain place, like targeted advertising. So if your phone tells the system that you're near something, then of course, this was where we thought LBS was really going to happen, was in, you walk by a store and the store says, I have a sale on, and your phone tells you that. This one, profile matching and dating, which is actually not way off market these days. There's lots of these happening. So you put yourself into a service and you want to get a date, and you will be matched with people in your proximity. And then there's proximity-based actuation, which means when your mobile device is in a certain place, things will happen. And the most common one is things like highway tolls. So you can charge up your phone with your highway expenses, and when you're close to when you go underneath the counter, it will just check it off. This one is in the list that I stole this from, but I have never seen this. Automatic airport check-in. So does that mean when I walk into the airport through the door, it was cha-ching, I've got my seat? Is that what happens? I don't know. That one's like way out there. I was surprised to see that. But anyway, there's the list is endless. It's simply imagination that determines what can be in this list. Okay, so I'm teaching this course right now, and I'm learning very, very quickly that my students are very familiar with these technologies. They're all using LBS all the time. And from my students, the ones that seem to be the most commonly used are Google Maps, OpenRice, and Facebook Places. So, and now what I've done here, I'm having a technology problem here in Hong Kong, because I live with my iPhone. You know, my iPhone is my world, and my iPad is my world, but it's an American iPhone, and I don't have cell service here in Hong Kong. And so I'm without cell phone. I cannot do all these things, like find my way around. Every time I go out, I get lost, and I can't find out where I am. So anyway, this is a picture from my cell phone of my iPad, which I mailed to myself and put on my computer, because I'm kind of having connection problems here. But anyway, that's Google Maps out of my iPad. And then OpenRice, and I actually had to download the Singapore one because the local one was in Chinese. I couldn't read it. So I downloaded the Singapore one. Now I don't know if I could find a restaurant here, but anyway. And then this is the Facebook Places one, which I hadn't actually paid any attention to, but the students here seem to be very commonly using Facebook Places, because I would use Foursquare. But apparently Foursquare doesn't work so well here. They seem to be using this Facebook Places. And then this one, the students just told me about, iToilet Finder. That's a great idea for an iPhone app, I think. And it's an international one, so you can take it everywhere. So there's lots of these things. It's not something that we're unfamiliar with now. If you have a smartphone, you have quite a bit of familiarity with these. If you don't have a smartphone, you should have. End of story. Okay, so LBS is hot now. It really is booming. And so good evidence of this for myself is this conference series called the WEAR 2.0 conference series. It's been going on for a number of years now, and I've actually attended the last 3 years. So I've been going to this thing for 3 years. I'm a university academic. This thing is for the grassroots and leading edge developers who are building location-aware technology, intersecting with the businesses and marketers and entrepreneurs seeking out location apps, platforms, and hardware to gain the competitive edge. That's the sort of language of this conference. And I'm going to this conference as an academic because it's location, and it's something about geographic information, which is what I do. And so it's got to be really interesting, I'm thinking to myself, to go to this thing. So I've been to it 3 years in a row now, and it's been an eye-opener for me, because in the first year I was there, these are young developers who are just taking free apps and building free stuff and getting free data and creating these things, and every once in a while one of them gets the hot app and like Foursquare and it works, and 100 of them don't get it and one of them does. And these are the guys trying to get the best app and try to find their little place in the market, and they're all there talking to each other and they're all talking about location and they're all trying to build these things. And I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, but what about the maps and what about the data and what's the accuracy of the data and where are you getting all your data from? And they're sort of going, it doesn't matter. And so it's been a really interesting thing for me to attend, because I'm there and it's all exciting and it's all about business, and to me it's all about location, which is my field, and yet they don't know anything about my field, and there's a whole bunch of fundamental principles in my field that they're not talking about. And when I go and talk to them and I say, well, what have you done about the error in that position? And they'll go, nothing. And so I'll say something to them about some of the issues and they'll go, can I have your card? Because I'm telling them things that they hadn't thought of. But that isn't really that important, because these guys are developers and businesses. And for them, building something is a matter of making it work now and attracting users. They don't have to make it work for everything. They just have to make it work for the 90% solution. So my little issues that I'm thinking of as an academic are the 10%, which we academics want to understand. If we were going to build an app, we would deal with that 10%, because that's the interesting part. And then we want it to work for all cases. So there's a disconnect between the way they're looking at this world of location by building a cool app, making it work mostly, good enough, and selling it. And for me going, but you forgot this really important piece, and to them it doesn't matter because it's not part of the business framework. So for me, I'm in this group of people and they're doing all this fantastic stuff, and they're going down paths that I would never go down because I know you shouldn't. And so they go down these paths and they think up all these really cool ideas and they kind of work. And maybe that's good enough. But it seems to me that there is some part of my world missing in what they're thinking. So this is the motivation for me doing this course here. And what I want to do in this lecture here is just drop in a few little nuggets from the lectures that I'm doing, just to give you a little sense of the kinds of geographic information science piece I think should be in here. And I think, of course I'm very biased, but I think that the developers would benefit by knowing some of these things. So that's my angle. So I look at that map, that picture I showed you before, and I see geographic information science all over this thing. First of all, the whole question of location. That is my world. What do they know about location? The services, restaurant finder, car navigation, finding things in the vicinity, these are all geographic information services that in our world, and in fact they're using our theory to run these things. It's our theory that made these things happen. What they're building as services are probably far better than any academic could build, but it's our fundamental theory that has worked out the algorithms. And then the content that feeds these things, a lot of geographic content in there, all our GIS data, and all sorts of maps, and all sorts of things about making maps and cartography that aren't happening. The map thing is the big hole in all of this. Everybody just uses Google Maps and they're done. So there's a bit of a piece that I think could be added to if they actually spent some time with maps. But anyway, within this context then there's a whole bunch of GI science. So to just run through, as I said, little nuggets of geographic information science as it sort of falls in this context, here's my plan. First thing is, of course, the location. So how does the mobile device know where it is? Determining location on the mobile device. And that's actually not GIS, but I put it in here because you kind of have to start there. So once you get a location, actually you got to know where it is. And it's not really a direct thing from getting a location to actually knowing where it is. So I'm going to talk something about how you figure out geographic coordinates. And then once you got coordinates, how do you put it on a map? if you want to put it on a map, you got to know about projections. And then how do they determine where that is? That's they, because those are the geodetic scientists that are engineers that don't talk like any of the rest of us. But it brings us to geodetic datums, which are heavy-duty stuff that makes really big differences in making all this stuff work. So I'm going to talk about that briefly. And then once we determine where it is, we want to know what place that is. And I'm going to then talk about this thing called indirect georeferencing. And then once we get there, what is there? And that's the topic of context and scale. So let's start with mobile location. I'm not going to spend long on here. Hopefully some of you already know this. But if you have a handheld device, there are several technologies that are used by the device to get a location for you, or by the service. Everybody knows the GPS one. So that's your cell phone looking up in the sky and finding four satellites that it can talk to and do a distance calculation and triangulate between them and get a location. In that particular case, your cell phone is doing the work. Your cell phone has the receiver and the algorithms. It figures out its location. Once it has a location, then it sends it to the service. So it's the only one where the cell phone itself is actively calculating the location and sending it to the service. This is the one that the iPhone collected in the iPhone scandal, which it isn't at all, but nevertheless. Okay, so then the next one, or the next ones are called network location. In this case, they're kind of passive from the phone's point of view. The phone is in the network, and if I have a location-based service, it can find my phone in the network. It can find it by its cell phone tower. So it can be whatever tower your phone is talking to. Or better yet, you might only be talking to one tower, but your phone can be seen by several towers. And the triangulation thing that it does with the satellites, it can do with cell phone towers. So the same kind of, if there are three cell phone towers and my phone can do the cell phone tower can do a time difference between sending and receiving. You can get distances, so the distances from all the towers, and you figure out your location. So it's kind of the same thing, but it's done with the towers, the cell towers. A really cool one's Wi-Fi location, and this one's is considerably problematic, but it's actually great for me because right now I don't have GPS or GSM because I can't get cell service here and I can't turn on my cellular receiver, but I can get Wi-Fi. And so what happens with the Wi-Fi locations is there is lots of companies who use this have databases of Wi-Fi base stations transmitting. And you know, if you turn on your smartphone, you turn it on, and you look for Wi-Fi locations, it'll give you a whole list of locations that it sees right now. So your phone knows which Wi-Fi stations it could possibly talk to. It might not connect to any of them, but it actually knows the IDs of those stations. And those IDs can be used in a database to calculate your position, if the database knows where all those Wi-Fis are. So there are databases being built on all that they're being corrected, built and corrected constantly of where all those little tiny local Wi-Fi signals are. And there are some companies where they have people driving the streets collecting that data. So if I go down this street, I pick up these five named Wi-Fi devices. And when I go down that street, I get these named ones. And those named Wi-Fi devices are used to locate your phone, which I thought was really interesting. GeoIP is just the physical address of the IP that your computer connects to. So if you connect into an internet, then the IP that your phone gets is your address. It's your GeoIP address. Those are great if you're in something like an office building or a university or something where they're really static. The IPs are connected to the wall. But they're no good if you go through a VPN, for example. You go in through a proxy connection so that I'm here in Hong Kong, I VPN into USC over in LA so I can watch American TV, and my phone will think it's over there. So that's a little problematic. And then there's a whole bunch of short range ones that are coming online now. Bluetooth, which you know only has a distance of 10 meters or something, and these are small distances and therefore smaller kinds of applications, and I won't go into those. But no matter what you're doing, the thing that gets figured out is a location value stated as a pair of numbers. That's what you get, is a location value stated as a pair of numbers. Now, of course, we need to know what that number is. And what do you do with that number, and what does it mean? So that number is your georeference. It's the geolocation of your phone. It's the location of your phone. You get it out of one of these, and you get that pair. So we finished the first one, determining location. Now I'm going to get to where is that location. Now there are two different ways that we give georeferences in GI science. One of them is the direct one, which is what we just saw, the coordinate. So the most accurate way of giving a location in geographic information science or in the location world is a coordinate system. The other one, which I'll come back to later, is the indirect ones where you use a name to connect to a location. I'll do that later. So if we stay in the rectangular reference or the direct georeferences, it's about coordinates. And coordinates, of course, are generically considered in this rectangular Cartesian space that we all learned in grade school geometry. So you have an x-axis and a y-axis and 0, 0 in the middle. And if you want to go to a point, you have an x value and you have a y value, and you just go off into that rectangular universe. And that's what a coordinate pair does. So that's just fine, and that's what we got out of our cell phone, was a coordinate pair. So where is that coordinate pair that we got? Well, the problem is the Earth is round. So we can't use that nice, clean, rectangular system because it doesn't work in the world. The world is round. So now we want to put a coordinate system on the Earth, but the Earth is round. We can't just use a square thing. So those bright fellows back in the 16s, 14s, or whenever they did this, it figured out this system, which is the system of latitude and longitude. You should all know that. You fail. Okay, so the latitude and longitude is what we, you know, sort of our generic understanding of a location coordinate pair. Of course, it's in that system. It's not a rectangular system at all. It's a angular system, which is why it's always stated in degrees, of course, because it's an angular system. The interesting thing is that these two systems are different, and it always puzzles me that they are, and I've often sort of tried to ponder how they could be the same, but maybe it can't be. So we have one coordinate system, which is the latitude system, which is the angle from the center of the Earth measured from the equator. So if I'm trying to find the latitude of this place, I'm taking an angle from the center of the Earth from the equator, angle it up, and this thing is showing 55 degrees, 30 minutes, and 0 seconds, with degrees and minutes breaking out in 60s, like time. So it's a measure from the equator, and the equator is fine because that is a physical geometric plane. It's the plane between the poles of rotation. So it's simple enough to find that plane on the geometric body. The other one, though, longitude, is actually quite different. It measures the angle from the center of the Earth from an arbitrary line to your location along the equator. So the problem is, where is zero? Because there isn't a physical geometric reason for making one particular line that runs from north to south the zero point. Any point on the Earth geometrically has the same value. So back when they were setting up this system, there were lots of prime meridians. They ran through each, like Paris had their own prime meridian, so all the longitudes in Paris, in France, were measured from a line of longitude that ran through Paris. And then there was one over here in the China, and there were several. The Indians had one. Everybody had their own line of longitude, which of course made it really difficult if you're sailing the world because you're moving around into different sets of coordinates. So at some point they did come to an agreement. The world agreed that it would run through Greenwich, England. So that, because the Greenwich Observatory was renowned or something, and they managed to win the bet. And so the zero line runs through Greenwich, England. And so we have measurements then in the east and west. We have 180 degrees going to the west and to the east. And in the north and south direction, we have measurements from 0 to 90, which is kind of funky. So latitude only goes to 90 in the north and south, and longitude goes to 180 east and west. So it's kind of a funky rectangular coordinate system, which is what we often think of it. So that's the first part of the story. So it looks like this. If you're trying to find the longitude and latitude of Redlands, you just measure along the equator to get the longitude, and north of the equator from the equator up north to get the latitude. And it's stated in degrees, minutes, and seconds. It's another little nugget. We call that DMS, and you do not ever want to compute in DMS, because these things are base 60, and you just cannot compute in base 60 on the digital computers. So if you get latitudes and longitudes that look like this, which is very often the way they are reported, if you go into Google Earth, that's what it reports you to, is these DMS measurements. If you write them into your little column and you're trying to do something with them, if you want to see, you know, how many degrees some place is west of another one, you have to convert all the minutes and seconds and figure out whether you're over 60, and it's really bad. So what you really want to do is put it in decimal degrees. So computing wise, you never want to see a DMS lat long. You want it to be a decimal degrees. You also end up, if you do it this way, you end up getting rid of the letters as well, which were also problematic in doing math. So you have north is positive, south is negative, east is positive, west is negative. And then all you have is two numbers with a lot of decimal places. So here, just because I thought I should have a local one, this is the DMS of Grad House at HKU. Okay, so the lesson to learn here is that lines of latitude are parallel. As you can see here, even on this projection, they're basically evenly spaced apart. So 10 degrees of latitude, or approximately 111 degree of latitude, is approximately 111 kilometers, sort of, all the way up. But lines of longitude converge at the poles. So the distance of 1 degree of longitude at the equator is about 111 degrees. Up here, it's about 55 degrees, and up here, it's nothing. So the problem with that, just to bring this, I'm going to keep coming back on this, the rectangular system that we often think of lat and long being, you cannot measure distances on it, because it depends where you are, north and south, on what the distance is east and west. So it's a very awkward system to use to do a lot of mathematical. You have to do angular stuff, of course, which isn't simple. Okay, so that's that, geographic coordinates. Okay, the next thing is, I've got this latitude, longitude thing, so I know where it is on the globe. Now, how do I put that on a map? And of course, the problem here is the Earth isn't flat. The Earth is a sphere, sort of. And so in order to put the Earth on a map onto my cell phone, for example, onto my mobile phone, which is a flat thing, or to put it in an atlas, which is a flat thing, or to put it on a desktop map, it's a flat thing. We don't carry globes around with us. We carry flat maps around with us. So we have got to have a way to take that angular coordinate system and swoosh it out onto something flat. So my little diagram here, which is my peeling the orange diagram, is what would happen if I just took the globe and tried to flatten it out. I would end up with something that looked kind of like this. And of course, these wouldn't be flat. But that's basically what would happen if you pulled the Earth apart. You're not going to get the nice square maps that we're familiar with. Now, you can make a nice square map. And it actually is a projection, which is called the unprojected projection, or in French, the plot carré. And what we do there is we just plot the latitude and longitude numbers as if they were rectangular. And you end up with these horrendous things like Antarctica being this massive continent at the south, and Greenland, and then there's scary Russia, because it's really, really big. And this is what you often see. This is big problem number one in the location-based services world, is they do not understand you should not do this with your coordinates. You should never just make a map from lat long as a rectangular coordinate system. It is entirely inappropriate. The map you get is useless. The sizes are incorrect. The directions are wrong. The distances are incorrect. The areas of continents like Greenland, this is the problem, the Greenland problem, where Greenland looks like it's as big as Canada, which it isn't. It's much, much smaller. And it's really simple, if you're a computer scientist, just to put the points on the map as if they're rectangular. So this is a really important piece. They should know not to do that. So how do you not do that? Well, you have to use a projection. And this goes back to the same time period as they're figuring out where the Greenwich Meridian is. You build a projection, and it literally is described as a projection from the center of the Earth through the grid of the Earth, with the lines of the grid falling on the paper being projected from the point in the center of the Earth going through the grid, and the lines then getting projected onto the surface. So the first sets of projections made were literal projections. And they have a set of three different what's called developable surfaces. And they're pretty simple. The cylindrical projections, you just put the Earth inside a cylinder, and you do the projection thing from the center of the Earth out through the grid, and it goes up onto the paper. So you can see how the lines of longitude here get projected as straight north and south lines. Or if you turn the Earth sideways and project it this way, then the lines of latitude get projected as straight lines. But the other ones get really funky curves. And you can also, pull it out a little so it doesn't sit inside, and this actually gives you some much better, much less distortion. So a lot of these things are done this way. They're called secant, so that the amount of distortion is less. So Mercator is one of the classic projections. We all learned to use Mercator when we were kids in school. It was one of the first projections that was widely used. It has some really important properties about angles of travel and areas that are useful particularly for ocean navigation if you're in a sailing ship. And so it has a history in the sailing world. And this is what it looks like. And a lot of maps are drawn that way. We still have the problem with the north and south near the poles getting extended. But it does do some better things in the middle. So there are a lot of Mercator projections in use. It's mostly just simply because it has a historical precedence. So there's what the Earth looks like in a Mercator projection. It's almost as bad as the Platte Carré, but slightly better. Okay, another whole set's the conic projections, and this is the one that we use in North America, and China would use as well. It's for countries that cover a lot of east-west distance and go sort of polar, so that because it is smaller up there. So if you project the Earth like Canada, it's a really good projection for Canada because it is small up here, and the country, the way it spans the lines of longitude, it fits really nicely. So it's also a good one, as I said, for China. And then there's another one where you just project it onto a plane, and you get this one, which I've used before. Gives you a nice perspective of the globe and gives you some sense of the 3D. And we see this one a lot now in all of our global things. The Earth from space, basically. It's really distorted. It's actually one you cannot use to do any math on, but it's a nice one to look at. And then there's a whole bunch of other projections, because projections are mathematical, and anybody who understands this can make a new projection. And in fact, I forgot. I was going to bring you guys all a projection to use in class, to take home. There's a projection, and one person's in my class, that is called the cube projection. And it's the math figured out to project the Earth onto a cube so that you could cut it out and fold it up and have a cubic Earth. And so it's just a matter of a mathematical transformation. These are all just mathematical transformations. These ones are called projections. They're not really projections anymore. So why do we have projections? Well, they were developed for creating paper maps. So they were developed so that we could take the Earth and flatten it out onto a piece of paper. And there's lots of different projections because they have different properties. So if you want to make a global map that shows something where the area of the countries matters, you choose a projection that preserves area. If you want to show something where the relationship between North and South continents are shown correctly, then you choose a different projection. Each projection has significant distortion, but they all have different reasons why you want them. There's books and books and books about projections, and you can, you know, do very much advanced study in it. But they were developed for creating paper maps. When you were this guy, Vermeer's famous geographer with his calipers, I can just see him building a single paper map, doing the mathematical calculations to put the coast of Spain onto the map by doing this mathematical transformation from the round Earth to X and Y coordinates. It makes sense. And so all of these transformations just simply are a mathematical equation where you give it the lat and long and you get an X and Y number, which in fact are the rectangular coordinates of the map. So it's a straight transformation from the surface of the Earth. The locations of the surface of the Earth, do the math, and you get an X and Y location on your piece of paper. So it works great if you're just doing one map, but if you're making more than one, if you're doing it in the computer, this is where the problems come, and this is another one of these things those guys out there don't know. This is three different projections of the states of the U.S. One of them's not projected. The green one's not projected. And then there's the Lambert conformal conic and the Mercator projections. If you center them all with whatever that place is the same, this is how much distortion there is in the continent of the U.S. by using those three different projections. Now just imagine if you didn't know such a thing existed and you went and got digital data, you wanted to overlay. I want to lay the boundaries of the states and then I want to put the highways on there, and I got it from some other source, and then I want to put the national parks on there, and I got it from some other source, and I didn't know that they wouldn't line up like this, and I just slash them on top of each other, nothing would be in the right place, because you've got to know what projections are used with your digital data. So you can't just go get the data, you got to know something about it. So that's that. Okay, but having said all of that, the Earth isn't round. So, it becomes harder. The Earth is squished. It's squished into an oblate spheroid. And this is not an oblate spheroid. This is just a spheroid. An oblate spheroid has the other axis also squished so that it's bulgy on the top and a little bit less bulgy on the bottom. So it's not like a round thing. It is a, you can define a math, there's a mathematical way to define an oblate ellipsoid. Sorry, an oblate ellipsoid. Ellipsoid. That's a mathematical formula. But it's not actually even that. It's actually really bumpy. So the Earth itself is not a nicely well-defined mathematical form. It's a bumpy rock. And so if you're trying to put a nice lat-long thing on this globe, it's a bumpy rock you're trying to put it on. So how do we deal with that? Well, we have the geoid. So now we have all these things that are the shapes of the Earth. First of all, we have the surface, the Himalayas, the deep sea trenches. So that's the topography. Then we have, in the other end of that is the geoid, or the ellipsoid, which is the mathematical surface that we can describe. And then we have the geoid, which isn't topography and it isn't the round ellipsoid, it's the gravity surface. And it defines, if the Earth was covered with water, and because of all the gravity that goes on, because of, you know, big mountains and all that stuff, the surface of the Earth could be determined by gravity, and they can measure that. So they can measure the gravity surface. That is the basic shape of the Earth that is now used. by the geodesists. So what happens then? So this is the bumpy Earth. Now I really want to put this coordinate system on there, but how am I going to know where the lines go on this surface because it's bumpy? So we have these things called datums, which are surfaces that are geometric surfaces, which were originally aligned to the surface of the Earth. And you would have a datum that just covered a little bit of the Earth because it wouldn't fit the whole Earth. So the famous one in the U.S. is the NAD-27 datum, which is anchored in Meads Ranch, Kansas. And that's where the surface of the Earth touches this mathematical surface. And all of the latitude and longitude positions in the continental U.S. were based originally on that surface. So there's a nice ellipsoid that was defined, anchored at Meads Ranch, and then all of the latitude and longitude are worked out on that. But if you're not in Meads Ranch, you're over there in Moscow, that thing's not going to work for you because it's not even touching the surface. So you define a different one over there and anchor it at the surface and build all your lat-longs based on that surface. And if you're down here somewhere, you got a different surface and you build it on that different surface. So the moral of that story is I'm on the Earth right here. This is the real place. But I'm trying to get the lat long. If I use this ellipsoid, I'm going to get a lat that's about that far from north. If I'm on this ellipsoid, I'm going to get one that's that angle from north. And if I'm on this ellipsoid, which I would never be, I'm going to have to do some sort of projection to here. And I'm going to be a lot further south in latitude on the red one than I am going to be on the white one. Exactly the same place on the surface of the Earth, but the thing that I'm projecting my grid onto is a different place. So you end up with this kind of problem, which are called datum shifts. And this is, you would not do this because this is Texas, the Capitol Dome in Texas. This is the place. And then this is where it would be in its latitude and longitude locations if you used all these different datums. And of course it's using ones that you wouldn't because they're on the opposite side of the Earth. The Indian one and the Tokyo one, the Australian. But nevertheless, if you use them, that's where they would be. And these circles go out to 1,000 meters. So you can have a very, very large error by just using the wrong datum or measuring in one datum and pretending it's in a different one, which happens all the time. You can easily have 10-meter shifts, with just a change between the 27 datum and the 83 datum in the same place. So the datum is really important. And basically, all you need to know is WGS-84, because it's the one that they use now. It's a different one, and I'm not going to go into it. It's actually one that's set in the center of the Earth. It's not set on the surface of the Earth, and it's a little bit more complex. And it's the world one. And it's the one they use in GPS. So usually when you get a GPS report, it will be WGS-84. And most things now are in that, but sometimes you get odd data that's something else. And then you're not going to have your coordinates lining up. And that means that the same place will have different coordinates. Not that it's actually in a different place on the projection. It's actually going to be reported with different coordinates because they're coming off the different datums. So the moral of this story is your direct geo-reference using a coordinate system, like the ones I get out of my cell phone, are dependent upon the geodetic datum and the projection. So you got to know the geodetic datum, and if it's on a map, you have to know what the projection is. So, for example, if you try to put these two together, they're not going to work. Just one little side note. This confuses me, and I don't exactly know how this works because I'm just learning this, but the world of Bing Maps and Google Maps, who now run our geographic information universe, even though they're nothing to do with geographic information people, have declared that the projection that everyone will now use is called the Web Mercator. And all of the data that you get out of those systems comes under Web Mercator. And if you're using real GIS data and you want to connect it to the Google Maps, Bing Maps, you got to go to Web Mercator. And that's not the world's best projection, but that's what they're using. It uses a spherical Earth. So, but we're going to live there because they're running the show now. Okay, so now we have our datums. We have a latitude, longitude. We know we can be in the right place, but now we want to know what that place is. What's there at that place? Now, this is the other half of the references. I did that one. Now we'll do the indirect one, which really is I'm at a place, and this, and I can give this place a name. And what can I do once I've given a place a name? So these are indirect references, and they allow you to make connections between data and places. The most common one we use is place names. So if I type into Google London, it will zoom my map over to London, and it will put that there somewhere in the city of London. So that is being used. I type in a name, and it finds the lat long to put it, the dot on the map. That's an indirect reference. So I'm not typing in the lat long, I'm typing in the name, and then it's going and looking up in some sort of catalog what the address, what the lat long is, and it goes and finds it. And we have lots and lots and lots of these kinds of indirect references we use all the time. Census zones and zip codes and postal codes and all sorts of administrative districts. And in Hong Kong, the slope management system is actually a really interesting local referencing system because it's very precise. And there's a lot of information. If you get the code of the slope, you can enter it into the website and get a map and everything. It's a very precise geographic referencing system. So you look on the slope, it has a little tag on it, you write down that number, that's its indirect georeference, take it into the website, and it will put it on the map, which turns it into a place, a location. Now the reason this is really important in GIS is because GIS is all about relationships, or mapping is all about relationships. So I have a table of data that I can get off the internet. I can, you know, get it from the government. I can make it up myself by counting things. But basically, it has a place name in one column and some data in the other column. As long as I have that, and then I can find the map that has all those places. This is the easy one. This is the U.S. map. There's the states. Here's the states. There's a little bit of an error here because these are written in their two-letter code. That one has the words, so we're assuming a translation is happening here. But I can take this table, which could be anything, and as long as I have a map that gives me the locations of all the places in the list, I just make a link, and then I can tie those numbers to the map, and I can make a map. And that's how it works. So that's indirect georeferencing, and we use it all the time. We have a place name, and that gives us, by some sort of lookup route, the dot on the map. So what does it mean to LBS? When you search for a location in Google Maps, you get a place marker. You expect to get a place marker. We're getting, you know, a lot more demanding now of our systems. And so now when you search, and if I type in the name of some park and it doesn't know where it is, well, how can that be? It's got to know where that is. So the databases inside Google Maps and all those other guys are growing monstrously because we keep asking it to tell us places that we use names for. And it might be, you know, just a local name. It's not the official government name. It's the name we all call it. And if it's not there, then I'm not going to use that service because it doesn't contain the things I'm looking for. So, place databases are big business. All the big guys are getting into building databases of places. They want to collect, I heard the person at Google at the conference I was at say, they want to have the world's biggest place database. They are in, that's their goal, to get the biggest one. But everybody else is after it as well. And the guy who gets it wins. So, what does that mean to us? Well, we're all helping them build this database. Because every time you check in somewhere, so checking in means that I'm in this location and I'm trying to check into this location. So I am sending my location into that check-in place. If my place isn't there and I want to name it, you type in the name of it, you send it off to them, they've suddenly got another entry in their database. They got your place and the thing you called it. Thank you very much. Which is why check-ins are so important. These guys are getting data out of us. The more people they can get to their site checking in, the more database they're going to get, and the closer to the prize they'll be. So it's not just all fun. So what does it do? It allows us to put a dot on the map for any place in the database, and then it allows you to associate those dots with other things that have the same name. So, for example, here, if I went into these databases for Admiralty Center, I could find all the things that had Admiralty Center as their place. I could have the stores that define this as their place. I could have the bus stops that are called this. I could have pictures that people have posted on the internet that have this word in it. I could find all these things that are associated with this place just through that name. And I could put a dot on the map that joins them all together. So, almost done. Okay, so I found my place. I know what it is. Now I want to know what's there. And this is the topic of context, which is a big topic in LBS, and I take a very, very narrow view of it. Context is really important in LBS, and this is a really important piece. LBS users are really, LBS are user-focused and task-specific, which means that when you make a request to an LBS, you have a single request, and you want a quick answer, and you're done, and you're gone. And if it doesn't give you that answer the way you wanted it, you're going over to the other guys because there's lots of competition out there. So they have to be able to give you your answer exactly what you want, really quickly, very specifically. And the only way, the guys who are going to win this one are the ones that can figure out where you are, what your context is, and what kind of information would be the most useful to you. And sometimes the information they're going to give you isn't what you're asking for because you don't actually realize that you want all this other information. So context, it has a lot of social things involved with it. Most of them are looking at social stuff. So if I'm in this place and I want to know where are the good restaurants around me, it will go find what my friends say and tell me what my friends say are the best restaurants around here. So that's my social context. And also my geographic context, of course, is where I am. So having knowing something about the place you are is really important to the LBSs. So context is in their definition in the LBS world. It's any information they can use to characterize your situation so that they can fine-tune their interaction with you. And context then includes where you are, very clearly. That's like number one. Who you are with, which is the whole social context, and that is the big growing area right now. And what is nearby, which is my piece, the geographic part. Now, figuring out what's nearby is actually fairly straightforward. We do spatial analysis. But what's interesting here, the final little piece of GI science I want to throw out here is scale. Because scale is, you know, we use the word scale. You know, what scale is it? Is it a big scale or a little scale? So we all have some sort of sense of talking about scale. And scale determines how much is nearby. So if I'm in London and I'm asking about where are the hotels in Hong Kong, the scale of my interest is much different than if I'm here at this place and I want to know where the hotel is. And so the scale of my concern is important. The problem with scale is we have lots of different ways that we talk about scale and we get them mixed up. And so it's really important to know whose language you're using when you talk about scale. So we basically have two, and they're opposite. We have the geographer's scale, the official mapping scale that we all use. We geographers use. And it's a nice one. It's mathematical. It's expressed as a ratio, and it says one unit on the map represents this one, 50,000 units on the ground. One unit on the map represents 1,000,000 units on the ground. So 1 centimeter on the map represents 1,000,000 centimeters on the ground. Of course, you can do all the, that would be how many, that thousand, and then, so it represents, what is it? I don't know. 1 centimeter represents 10 centimeters or something. You know, you can do the math. Just move the numbers over. It's really important to remember in this scale, this is a ratio. So a 1 to 50,000 map is larger than a 1 to 1 million map. You think of it as as a fraction. It's a ratio, so it's like a fraction. So a 1 to 50,000 fraction is a bigger fraction than to a 1 to 1 million fraction. So in my world, something that is 1 to 50,000 is larger than one that's 1 to 1 million. And that means that the 1 to 50,000 has more detail, has more stuff in it, because you're looking at much closer part of the Earth, but it's a smaller area. Okay, the other way, oh, So we have this. So here's what scale looks like as a representative fraction. Here's a map that possibly is drawn at 1 to 1 million. Here's a little piece of it, which then, if I expanded it like I've done here, would become 1 to 100,000. And there's a little piece of it, and it's a 1 to 10,000. And what you notice as we move through these, this has got all the streets in it, this has just the highways, and this one has just the major roads and a little bit of the terrain. So the amount of detail that's covered in the map decreases as you go down in scale to the bigger number. And the area covered gets bigger. So the 1 to 1 million is a regional map. The 1 to 10,000 is a local map. Why is the use of representative fraction inappropriate in this slide? Because the one I'm looking at here is this big, and the one you're looking at is that big. On this one, that distance is not the same as on there. So when you're doing it projection-wise, it's totally irrelevant to use these kind of scales. You often see, the thing is, you often see it associated with GIS data. People often, in fact, Hong Kong does that. The lens department, the data they sell is sold as scales. So you can buy the 1 to 1,000 scale and the 1 to 10,000 scale and the 1 to 50,000 scale. It's not the scale of the data, it's the scale of the source, which is basically the same thing of those pictures I showed you before. If it's a 1 to a million source, it's going to have a certain kind of data on it, a certain amount of generalization, because the roads are going to be, you know, just moving slowly. You're not going to see all the curves and bends in the roads. So there's a problem with expanding data, and okay, I said all that, I think. I think I said all that. Here's the reason why you don't want to put the 1 to 10,000 on there. You really, just a little sideline, if you're going to do this with maps, you should have a bar scale on them, not a word scale, because the bar scale will expand with the map. So no matter how big the map is, the bar will be the same size as it should be in relation to everything else. Okay, the opposite way of doing scale is extent. And this is the more common way, the way the world talks about scale. And that's a simple one. We talk about large scale and small scale things. So a large scale project has a lot of people in it, right? A small scale project will have a few people in it. So we end up with this opposite thing going on. If you use scale to describe the extent, then the word large scale would be this is large scale and extent, small scale in RF. Let me go to the next one. This is small scale and extent and large scale in RF. So this is a large scale in the fraction because the number of units on the map are less here than they would be on the previous one. But it's a small scale because I'm only looking at a small area. Whereas in this bigger one, it's a bigger area. This is a zoom in part of that one. So this is large scale if I'm speaking extent. It's small scale if I'm talking representative fraction. So just be careful when you talk to people about scale that you know which language you're using. Okay, I'm just about done here. What does this have to do with LBS? It simply says that what's in context depends on scale. So scale is important. And a discussion of scale in terms of what gets shown needs to include this language of scale. Okay, and so there's all my little hot things I wanted to tell you. As you can see, there's lots to know. It's not simply a matter of putting dots on a rectangular thing and saying you're done. So that's why I'm teaching this class, and I'm hoping that my students will, some of them will be inspired to become really informed LBS developers. So thank you all.